B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, April 22nd, 2019. It's Earth Day. And it always happens this way. It's the day after my birthday. I want to thank all the people who used every communications platform to reach out and wish me a happy one. Turned out that way. A beautiful day here in the Bay Area. And, of course, it aligned with Easter Sunday, so there were plenty of festivities all around. And since it is Earth Day, I briefly want to acknowledge those who are protesting. The climate activists who call themselves Extinction Rebellion. For 2 weeks now, they have been protesting daily in London. And the scene today where they have occupied the Natural History Museum in London, they're in some sort of outfits that look a lot like Game of Thrones, like the Walking Dead. Anyway, I applaud them for calling attention and trying to raise awareness of the need for the Earth to, the population of the Earth to deal with the damage that we've done. And later today, I'll be recording a video interview for local television with longtime climate scientist Guy McPherson. And he's controversial because he is not as conservative with his predictions as many of the experts. And I hope to have that interview probably shared with my podcast network by the end of this week. So on Friday, Senator Elizabeth Warren, reacting to the Mueller report, became the first Democratic senator to call for the impeachment of Donald Trump. Now, I have interest in the candidacy of Elizabeth Warren for president. And I see some pros and cons. A little bit later, I'm going to talk about some of her policy initiatives. I give her a lot of credit for that. I'm not sure Elizabeth Warren could beat Donald Trump. And so, I have not endorsed a candidate for 2020. And I'm shopping and evaluating all of them. My leanings are toward Bernie because I believe that he has the most consistent progressive positions. But as I have acknowledged, his weakness on foreign policy, Elizabeth Warren doesn't have strong foreign policy views that I embrace either. So on Friday night, I posted on Facebook after watching an interview with Rachel Maddow and Elizabeth Warren. And I wrote a simple statement. Great to see Senator Liz Warren take strong stand for impeachment. That's leadership. And I got a whole wave of responses, about 50 comments. And some of them agree with me about impeachment. But most of them took the opportunity to take a swipe at Elizabeth Warren. Our friend Carl Howard. Now, about that wishy-washy foreign policy, it's a fair comment. I don't think it is germane to what I posted. John Schoenebaum, who is a writer who lives in England, he posted, she's basing it on belief in the whole Russian meddling line, though, which makes it ridiculous and dangerous, or so it seems to me. Now, that's a fair comment. And I do have concerns about the Democrats who haven't actually embraced the findings of the Mueller investigation. And in some cases, they accept his exaggerated claims of the Russian interference, the sweeping interference, as he characterized it, in the election. So John has a reasonable argument there. But many people, as happens in a Facebook post, kind of attack each other, and people will pair off and go back and forth. And I find some of it amusing. And here's a comment from Shenley. He says, I'm not so sure it's leadership, Peter. I think it's opportunism on her part, as she is not doing well in the polls, and her new call for his impeachment gets her good publicity. Okay, I don't object to that. And I also feel that I'm going to accept support for Trump's impeachment from anybody. I will celebrate Republicans who I think are wrong on all the issues and morally bankrupt for their support of Trump so far. And so this isn't about the 2020 election and singling out a Democratic candidate. To me, Elizabeth Warren has shown some pretty important leadership in bucking her own party's political leaders who say, don't impeach, it'll backfire on us. And as you know, I believe that that is an expedient route that I do not support. I think even if it costs the Democrats politically, they should move forward with impeachment of Trump. And I don't know who this woman is or how she ended up on my Facebook friends list, Elena Marie Bridges. She often comes out of the woodwork to snipe at any embrace of our political system. She wrote, glad to see who the easily grifted rube, who is the easily gifted rube by yet another politician scammer. By the way, Pete, I've got a bridge for sale and am prepared to offer you a very special price. You should be fine with the price as you've already sold your soul to these D.C. killers destroying not just this country, but the planet. And here's our pal Kyle. If she was impeaching for war crimes, I'd be on board. But she won't because the Democrats are just as guilty. Well, again, we are not going to find the members of the Democratic Party who are in elective office today, by and large, willing to embrace our reasons for impeaching Trump. And I will accept the expedience of whoever comes to support what I think is the proper outcome. Now, I was busy over the weekend, and that's the way Bill Barr planned it, that we'd be preoccupied with family activities, and it was Passover, Easter. And so I got to read about another 50 pages of the Mueller report. And the part I've linked to takes you to Volume 2, the executive summary, factual results of the obstruction investigation. And as you know, I believe that Trump has been vulnerable to impeachment ever since Michael Cohen entered into the guilty plea over the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and the Playboy playmate, Karen McDougal. And this is why I think that the whole drama of Democrats saying, we can't impeach him till we have the Mueller report. Well, you've got it, and now they're coming up with other dodges to what I consider to be their constitutional duty. So the Mueller report, and I encourage you, the executive summary runs about 15, 16 pages, and it helps us understand, number one, what I call the limited hangout. Mueller knew from the very beginning of his appointment as special counsel that he would never recommend an indictment of Donald Trump. He was going to submit to the existing policy, which is not a law, that a sitting president can't be indicted. That is a huge flaw in the whole process. And as I pointed out, St. Bob Mueller doesn't have the independence of the independent counsel, Ken Starr, who took up the Clinton proceedings that led to impeachment. So this was doomed from the beginning. And all the people in the media and political operatives who said, Mueller, 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 this is going to give us what we need, they were playing a shell game. Because they could have known, should have known, many did know, the limits of this investigation. So, the Mueller investigators, the lawyers who wrote this piece, do make a strong case that in various instances, Trump, who was running clear cover-ups, trying to prevent embarrassment, trying to put the lid on what he saw as efforts to force him out of office, I believe he did obstruct justice. And some people describe the Volume 2 of the Mueller report as a roadmap for Congress. And I think that's fair. There is plenty here for Congress to work with if they seriously want to pursue an investigation and potential removal of the president. And a little bit later, we'll talk about the politics of impeachment and the timing. So I encourage you to read this. It lays out the issues related to the alleged lies of Mike Flynn about his contacts with the Russian ambassador and whether they discussed the sanctions the U.S. had imposed on Russia, the president's firing of the FBI director, James Comey. And it goes into, reasonable detail about what Trump's apparent comments were, what that meant about his, what we can infer about his motives. And it's very interesting to hear Mueller, the special counsel, talk about Trump's efforts to remove the special counsel. Mueller's name never appears here, and they don't actually name Trump. They keep referring to him as the president. And what is really significant here is that Trump repeatedly attempted to obstruct justice by calling his White House counsel, Don McGahn, at home, demanding that he first tell Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein over the Justice Department that they needed to rein in Mueller by redefining the scope of his investigation. Several efforts to persuade and then humiliate Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III into unrecusing himself. And as we reported on Friday, the unlikely heroes in this case, the people who prevented Trump from further degrading himself and expose himself to deeper political peril and legal peril, they protected him by ignoring the directives he gave them. Corey Lewandowski, told to deliver a message to Sessions, dilly-dallied for a month, and then Trump asked him again. He tried to get somebody else to do it, and that other guy, Rick Dearborn, he didn't want to do it. And so what I heard from Rush Limbaugh this morning is that, hey, no collusion, no obstruction. And then he used a kind of silly voice to mimic unnamed critics who, like me, say that attempted obstruction is a violation of the law, just like provable, actual, completed obstruction of justice is. And the right, in defense of Trump, tries to declare, well, he may have tried that, but nothing happened, so it doesn't matter. But if you read beyond the executive summary, as I have, in Volume 2 of the Mueller investigation report, you will see a little primer on the law. And it says, endeavoring to obstruct justice, attempting to obstruct justice, those are violations of the same statute. And in addition to what I just mentioned, the Mueller report references the Michael Cohen incidents. And then they go into a kind of internal argument, saying that, you know, because this concerned a sitting president, they described what are called facially lawful acts. On the face of them, they're lawful. For him to fire Comey is within the president's known powers. But if he did it with corrupt intent, then that becomes obstruction of justice. So Mueller writes, in particular, the actions we investigated can be divided into two phases, reflecting a possible shift in the president's motives. The first phase covered the period from the president's first interactions with Comey through his firing of Comey. During that time, the president had been repeatedly told he wasn't personally under investigation. Soon after the firing of Comey and the appointment of the special counsel, however, the president became aware that his own conduct was being investigated in an obstruction of justice inquiry. At that point, the president engaged in a second phase of conduct involving public attacks on the investigation, non-public efforts to control it, and efforts in both public and private to encourage witnesses not to cooperate with the investigation. Judgments about the nature of the president's motives during each phase would be informed by the totality of the evidence. And then they kicked the ball over to Congress. We concluded in the rare case in which a criminal investigation of the president's conduct is justified, inquiries to determine whether the president acted for a corrupt motive should not impermissibly chill his performance of his constitutionally assigned duties. The conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction laws to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of office accords with our constitutional system of checks and balances and the principle that no person is above the law. And then they go into the statement that's been widely circulated that the evidence we obtained presents difficult issues that would need to be resolved if we were making a traditional prosecutorial judgment. At the same time, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and applicable legal standards, we're unable to reach that judgment. While this report does not conclude the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Now, what's missing here is a clear referral to the House Judiciary Committee, which is where impeachment would begin. And it's one of the reasons why I have faulted Bob Mueller for conducting a limited hangout investigation. Never intended to go all the way. Now, since I am a staunch proponent of impeachment, and tomorrow I'm scheduled to record a in-depth interview with John Boniface, who's at a nonpartisan group that is supporting impeachment, I wanted to offer you the other side. This comes from a lefty, by the way. His name is, it's not printed properly here on the page, Bhaskar Sunkara. He's the founding editor of Jacobin magazine, and he is the author of The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme. So he's no, you know, Heritage Foundation kind of guy. And he says that with the Mueller report, this struggle is brewing in the Democratic establishment between those who want to focus on defeating Trump in an electoral contest and those who want to go down the road of impeachment. And let me spoil it for you. At the end of his column, he says, the way to defeat a right-wing political coalition is through left-wing politics, not theater. And he says that impeachment is just theater, and it is political theater. It's one of the reasons I support it. We need these theatrics to drive home to the dunderheads who support Trump that he is a corrupt guy who has lied repeatedly and does not represent their interests. And that's why I support impeachment. All of these separate different investigations do not have the same impact. They don't get televised. And while I do understand that many people will support impeachment for motives that you and I don't approve of, as I said at the beginning, I don't care. Because the grounds are there to impeach him. The imperative of action under the Constitution is there. And I believe that it is just completely wrong to allow politics to prevent it. So Trump is trying to, what do they say, seize defeat from the jaws of victory. That's the line. And he claims he's been exonerated, no obstruction, no collusion, let's move on, boom, boom, boom. But he is so insecure in his victorious position that he spent the weekend hate-tweeting Don McGahn, the guy who protected him from himself. Protected him from further legal liability for ordering the, you know, variously the firing of Sessions, the firing of Mueller, that kind of interference. And I haven't seen any tweeted responses from McGahn, but I don't follow Trump or McGahn on Twitter, and I barely look at it. So that's really priceless. New York Times reported that the man who claims to, of course, be like really smart and a stable genius and a man with one of the world's greatest memories, during his take-home exam, the quiz, that substituted for any kind of interrogation of Trump by the Mueller investigators, more than 30 times he said that he had no memory of what they were asking about. I do not remember. I do not recall. I have no recollection. I have no independent recollection. I have no current recollection. And this is not surprising. In the deposition in the lawsuit about Trump University, just one of his other long cons, he used this dodge 24 times. And historically, Tricky Dick Nixon, he counseled people who were going before the Watergate grand jury. He flatly said, you can stonewall it. You can say, I don't remember. I can't recall. History does repeat itself, often in exact quotes, verbatims. One of the fascinating things so far is that other than Mitt Romney, who made some kind of milquetoast comments that he doesn't want to remove Trump, but boy, this shows how corrupt he is. He doesn't use the word corrupt. It's all sanitized language. But beyond that, most Republicans just observing radio silence. Oh, I've got to talk with the Easter Bunny here. I can't talk to reporters right now about the Mueller report or about impeachment. And we're also seeing renewed interest in the Steele dossier, the origins of the investigation into Russiagate, the FISA warrant that led to the surveillance of Carter Page in the summer of 2016. And as you know, I believe there's a lot to investigate there. There are whole portions that Mueller didn't touch. And yet, I don't trust Bill Barr to conduct an investigation that you and I might actually be able to rely on. One of the other things that I find really offensive and problematic is the way pundits in the corporate media take Mueller's Volume 1 and declare, as Mark Shields, he's the so-called liberal commentator on PBS, he repeatedly used the language on his Friday slot that Russia sabotaged and subverted our election. And this is dangerous. Because, as you know, I believe that the level of so-called Russian meddling was such small scale, and it was exaggerated for the political witch hunt. Yes, it is a witch hunt. And I hate to, underscore what Trump says. At any rate, those claims are very dangerous because Russia didn't sabotage the election or subvert it. It was Americans who did that. Some who made massive profits from it. You know, like CNN, Jeff Zucker, like CBS, the former head Les Moonves bragged about how much money they were making on the Trump election campaign just by covering it. And here comes the Washington Post congratulating the Washington Post for how great they did on Russiagate. And, of course, they were the recipients, along with the New York Times, of a lot of calculated leaks. And they ran with those leaks, and sometimes they got it wrong. But in this account, what the media got right and wrong, penned by Aaron Blake today, they properly note that BuzzFeed, claiming that Michael Cohen had been directed by Trump to lie to Congress, that didn't pan out. Whether Michael Cohen was ever in Prague, the special counsel says basically that there is no evidence that he was in or near Prague. Well, in Prague. The near part is now being disputed by the Post there. Then there was the case about Alpha Bank. This is a Russian server that was communicating with a server in Trump Tower. We think for the purposes of generating spam emails. But Rachel Maddow made a big deal out of this. And let's see which Slate was the original source of that story. Then The Guardian reported that Paul Manafort had visited Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London 3 times. And Mueller says nothing about that. The only real mentions, Mueller tries to paint a picture that Julian Assange was being deceptive when he offered the reward for the information related to the murder of Seth Rich. And by the way, later this week, I'm scheduled to talk with Bill Binney, the former technical director at the NSA, who has been one of my most reliable sources on skepticism for Russiagate. This Post story also talks about Deripaska and Kilimnik. That is the one story that the Washington Post reports in the Washington Post that the Washington Post got it wrong. Sunday's New York Times included a lengthy piece from the front page jumping to the inside of the front section. Headline, Putin marshaled his oligarchs to find back channels to Trump. Now, this infers a very sinister motive. But on the day after Trump was declared the winner here in the United States, in Moscow, they realized they didn't have any connections to him. despite all of the coverage here that claims there were 100 people with connections to Russians, right? And so he called in his oligarchs. And he said, bros, I've helped you get rich. Now help me find ways to communicate with Trump Co. And the motive was to get Trump to ease the sanctions on Russia. This is not secret, dastardly, underhanded stuff. Now, you can argue about the sanctions and whether Ukraine, we'll get to Ukraine here in a minute, is, worthy, whether Russia should suffer sanctions for its actions toward Ukraine. And so it goes. I'm going to keep reading the Mueller report, and as I do, I will update you on my commentary. It'll take a while, so you'll be getting it in installments. And, you know, people make installment payments to support the Peter B. Collins podcast. We call them subscriptions. And they're great people like Benny Alto in Oregon, Joe Carson in Tennessee, Jeff Ratner, who has a new annual subscription, and Cliff Johnson. They all support my work with $5, $10, $20 a month or the $50 annual subscription. You can do it too. Visit peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber. You land on the sign up page and boom, you can take care of business. And I have bonus books for new annual subscribers who supply a mailing address in the continental U.S. Currently offering the book 2100, Dystopian Utopia. It's an architect's vision of the planet 2100 after 4 degrees warming. Fascinating book. I'd love to send you a copy. So today, the circuit court in the 4th District rejected an appeal from Chelsea Manning with little explanation. Manning has challenged her continuing confinement. After all, they've arrested Julian Assange, and she's being held for refusing to testify to the WikiLeaks grand jury. Manning argued that the district court improperly denied her motion concerning electronic surveillance. She says she was being hounded, even by strangers who would walk up to her and make a bizarre conversation. She also asked to be released on bail because she's not a flight risk, and because the testimony they appear to be seeking is testimony she gave in excruciating detail in her own military court-martial in 2010. I'm sorry, in 2013. And we don't have much, as I say, detail from the court. Even BuzzFeed, which is not very sympathetic to Manning or Assange, the headline reads, Julian Assange was arrested. So why is Chelsea Manning still in jail? And Senator Rand Paul, the unpredictable libertarian from Kentucky, has announced a proposal to offer immunity from prosecution for Assange in exchange for his testimony at a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. Quote, I think he should be given immunity from prosecution in exchange for coming to the U.S. and testifying. I think he's been someone who has released a lot of information. You can debate whether or not any of that has caused harm, but I think he really has information that's probably pertinent to the hacking of the Democratic emails that would be nice to hear. Well, as you know, I dispute the hacking part. Caitlin Johnstone, in another brilliant essay published at Consortium News today, debunks that the claim that Assange is a Russian agent. A few juicy quotes. Not even the U.S. government alleges that WikiLeaks knowingly coordinated with the Kremlin in the 2016 publication of Democratic emails. The Mueller special counsel alleged only that Guccifer 2.0 was the source of those emails, and a persona covertly operated by Russian conspirators. The narrative that Assange worked for or knowingly conspired with the Russian government is an hallucination of the demented Russia hysteria, which has infected all corners of mainstream political discourse. There is no evidence whatsoever, and anyone making this claim should be corrected and dismissed. She says, to this day, we have been presented with exactly zero hard evidence of the U.S. government's narrative about Russian hackers. We've seen indictments from Mueller, but indictments are assertions, and assertions are not evidence. And as I mentioned the other day, when I read the so-called hacking section of the Mueller investigation, because of redactions, there is no evidence that is available to the public. And it simply reasserts what was published in the indictments last July 13th. And that is presented as the evidence of Mueller's investigation. It's really insulting. And she writes, invisible evidence is not evidence, no matter how many government officials assure us it exists. She goes on, for his part, Assange has stated unequivocally that he knows for a fact that the Russian government was not WikiLeaks' source for the emails, telling Fox News in 2017, our source is not the Russian government or any state party. Johnstone says you may be as skeptical or as trusting of his claim as you like, but the fact of the matter is that no evidence has ever been made public which contradicts him, and we know that Mueller made no effort to contact or interview Julian Assange. He wasn't interested in his side of the story. I want to commend two of our listeners, and they happen to be twin sisters, Kathleen McGuire and Colleen McGuire. And they're both subscribers and regular listeners. I hear occasionally from Kat and Colleen. And I was a little tickled to see that my buddy, Andrew Craig at the Justice Integrity Project, published a column by the twin sisters over the weekend. And they are alerting you, as I have reported previously, that Glenn Greenwald and others at The Intercept have announced that they are shutting down the Edward Snowden archives. And a tantalizing figure here that I don't see a source for, but I accept their claim. Since 2013, only 10% of the Snowden documents have been published. And I can't confirm or deny that number. I actually think it might be lower than that. And Laura Poitras, who was part of the team that helped set up The Intercept with Pierre Omidyar's money, she went public in March, informing us of the shutdown of the archives. And the McGuire sisters write, Poitras was basically screaming bloody murder as the research team investigating the treasure trove was being 86'd. And they raise questions about Greenwald and his position. Greenwald says that four media outlets, The Post, The Times, The Guardian, and Germany's Der Spiegel, have large parts of the Snowden archives and have had them since 2013. And that there are big media companies with budgets and newsrooms far larger than The Intercept. Now, Pierre Omidyar is a billionaire who has spent pretty freely on The Intercept. Reports indicate that Greenwald has earned as much as $500,000 a year for his columns at The Intercept. And the McGuire sisters properly note, it is disingenuous of Greenwald to insinuate that the four media companies who have large parts of the archives have commensurate access to the archives as the alleged individuals and institutions who have full access. So it's clear that we're lacking transparency here. So, Kat, Colleen, thanks for your commentary. I certainly appreciate it. Couple of quick stories here as we wrap up today. Herman Cain, Mr. 999 in the 2012 presidential primaries. He has withdrawn his name from consideration to be nominated to the Federal Reserve Board after we were reminded of the allegations of sexual harassment that derailed his bid for the presidency back in 2012. And one groper takes care of another. Seth Moulton, a centrist Democrat from Massachusetts, who was one of the people who opposed Speaker Nancy Pelosi's election as Speaker, he's announced he's running for president. He is a Harvard-educated Marine veteran. He's focused on recruiting other vets to run for Congress, and he is likely to focus on national security issues and present himself as a moderate. I think we got a lot of moderates out there. Mayor Pete and Amy Klobuchar and Kirsten Gillibrand. Elizabeth Warren is the one who's really distinguishing herself with a whole range of policy proposals, including now a plan worth $1.25 trillion to cancel most student loan debt and eliminate tuition at every public college. Bernie saying, I told you so. And finally today, what is described as a coordinated terrorist assault on Colombo, the main city in Sri Lanka that occurred on Easter Sunday, has killed nearly 300 people and injured more than 500 others. And the New York Times is reporting that the security entity in Sri Lanka had advance information. Names, addresses, phone numbers, the times in the middle of the night that one suspect would visit his wife. And this is being blamed on a local group called the National Tawhid Jamaat, which translates to something. I had it here. And they're also blaming it on the Islamic State, although I've seen no evidence to support that or a claim from the Islamic State. And there's a whole political squabble going on. And the current prime minister apparently has been excluded from meetings by the president. And just the day before, the New York Times reported that a former defense minister, the brother of a former president named Rajapaksa, he was served with papers at a Trader Joe parking lot near Los Angeles last week before he flew to Sri Lanka. And this is a lawsuit aimed at bringing him to justice for claims of crimes against humanity while he was the defense chief for 10 years starting in 2005. And thousands of people disappeared or were tortured during that period. So I don't know much about Sri Lanka or its politics, but this is a deadly attack, and there seems to be a whole subtext of political infighting. And I thought that was my last story, but I can't let this one go. Great comments from Kevin Zeese on the huge landslide runoff election in Ukraine over the weekend, elevating a former comedian who had played a president on television but has no prior political experience. His name is Volodymyr Zelensky, and he gets the last laugh because the Candyman, billionaire Petro Poroshenko, barely got 25% of the vote. And there's good comment here from Kevin Zeese, published at Consortium News today, about the ongoing corruption in Ukraine and the extent to which the U.S. knew how corrupt Poroshenko was when we traded Yanukovych by backing the coup against him for Poroshenko. And this appears to be a desperate effort on the part of the citizens of Ukraine to rid their nation of corruption by electing a total outsider. We'll see who's laughing in short order. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it with everyone. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.